History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And say it with me, do they have to go untold? No, not as long as we're willing to ask a few questions and invest a little time in listening with an ear toward understanding. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our men and women in uniform. March 29th every year is set aside as National Vietnam War Veterans Day. It falls on a Saturday this year, and I thought I'd mention it this weekend so you'd be prepared to track down an event in your area. You never know just how much it may mean to the Vietnam veteran in your life when you say thank you, or especially, welcome home. We get to meet a special Vietnam vet in Loveland, Colorado today named Bart Bartholomew. He has made a difference in the lives of countless vets through an organization appropriately named Veterans Honoring Veterans. You might as well pull it up right now for reference at veteranshonoringveterans.org. We're going to hear more about the origins, what the group does, and how you might want to participate in a bit. But we always like to go back to the beginning. So, Bart, why don't you tell us where you grew up and what you remember about your early years?
Well, I tell you what, it was in eastern Colorado, Burlington, Colorado, right on the state line. Born and raised out there, graduated in 67, got my draft notice. But before I got my draft notice, my mom and I convinced my mom to co-sign and get me my first brand new car. So we bought a 1967 Chevelle, not a mom's car, but a kid's car. And shortly after I got that 67 Chevelle, I got my draft notice. I just graduated from high school and want to start working around Burlington, but got my draft notice, so I went across the state line and into Kansas and talked to a Navy recruiter and asked him if I could turn this draft card into a Navy card, and he says, yeah, he said, we can do that. So didn't want to really go to Vietnam. Had a few friends already been over there and heard a little bit about the stuff, so I decided Army wasn't for me. My dad was in the Army, my brother was in the Navy. I heard better stories from my brother than I did from my dad. Didn't really get to talk to my dad too much. We were separated when I was young. But anyway, got drafted, joined the Navy, got sent to an aircraft carrier right out of boot camp. Went on my two-week furlough and came back and went to Long Beach, California, and got put aboard the USS Valley Forge. Valley Forge was commissioned in right after World War II as a CVA, aircraft carrier attack, and it had fixed-wing airplanes on it, and it was very instrumental. In fact, it was the first aircraft carrier that had its planes going to North Korea during the Korean conflict. So Korean War. So in 1960, the Navy got their heads together and they said, we are getting into a conflict with Vietnam, and it looks like it's going to be pretty much a ground battle. We're going to need infantry in country a lot. So they decided to take the flight deck for the fixed wing off the aircraft carrier, which had the catapult and the tail hook and all that stuff. And then they put a different type of deck on it that would allow helicopters to land on it, a little bit softer to absorb the cushion when they come down. So my job when I got on there, I was not rated, so I didn't have a designation of what I was going to do when I come out of basic training. So as we come aboard, they start looking at our papers from basic training and say, you go here, you go there, and you go here. And my go here was an outfit called Combat Cargo. And what Combat Cargo did is pretty much handled all the stuff that came on and went off the ship. We would take it off from ship to ship, and we would bring it in by helicopter, and then we'd store it in what they call the bowels of the ship, way down below decks. I was part of that Combat Cargo crew, and the interesting part about that job was we would lay out probably a 20 by 20 cargo net, and we put five or six stacked pallets, even more sometimes, and then we'd bring all four of those corners together, and they had metal round hooks on them, and we put them all together, and then we put a big long pole. It was a kind of fiberglass, and we would stand underneath helicopters, CH-46s, as they would come in. They would guide on us as it was coming over us, and then we would stand there until they got close enough, and then they had a big old cargo hook on the bottom of the aircraft, and then we would hook that up, and then we'd walk off to the side of the aircraft so the pilots could see us, and that give them the go-ahead to take the cargo and go. So I did that for 3 years, but take you back to Burlington, Colorado just for a moment. In 67, when I first got over there, I hadn't been in the Navy but maybe 6 months. I was working on the flight deck, and I got a notice that a telegram from American Red Cross. There was no cell phones, was no landlines, anything like that, so it was a telegram. And my dad had a massive heart attack in Denver, and he wasn't expected to leave, so they awarded me what they call emergency leave. So I grabbed what I could as far as my shaving gear and stuff like that, and got the next helicopter into Da Nang, Vietnam, and from there I went to Okinawa, and Okinawa back to the States, and then I got to see my dad. And he was in pretty bad shape, and then I got in there late morning, early afternoon, and they woke him up for his medications and talked to him a little bit, and I got to see him and visit with him, and then he just immediately went right back to sleep. So since all I had was my uniform, I told the nurses, if he wakes up, tell him I'll be back tonight. I got to go out to Eastern Colorado and get some civilian clothes, because all my stuff was still there. It hadn't been very long that I saw it, so it's just kind of like a little vacation I was on. So I hitchhiked. The hitchhiking is something that will have people think a little bit about, because back in the 60s, it was not real cool for a military man to be in uniform in the civilian population because of the Vietnam War. They didn't like it, so there was an awful lot of protesting, and a lot of veterans, or a lot of military men, not veterans, were not treated really, really kindly by the American population. So I didn't know anything about that. Here again, I just turned 18 years old and wet behind the ears, as they say, and got out there on the highway and stuck my thumb up, and within two or three cars, a vehicle pulled over to pick up, and I thought, man, this is pretty cool. It didn't take me very long. As I got up to the tailgate, he spun his tires, spit gravel all over me, and which kind of hurt because the little pebbles, and I thought, man, I don't know what I did there, but the guy left, and I didn't think anything about it. Just kind of brushed myself off, and within half an hour, I got a ride, and the guy took me all the way. In fact, took me to the doorstep to my home in Burlington, and went in and surprised mom. But the reason I tell you this story is because what happened when I was in Burlington just for a couple hours affected pretty much the rest of my life until 2020. I had my 67 Chevy, and I hadn't drove very much, so mom had made a meal for me, and I said, I'm going to go downtown, I'm going to drive around. And if anybody has any idea what Dragon Main or Cruising Main is, you just go up and down three blocks, which are very, very short. You wave and honk every time you see somebody. It might be one time, it might be 100 times, but you wave and honk. So we thought it was cool. It seems kind of silly now, but, well, there was this car from Kansas, a little 59 Ford Galaxy, two girls in it, and Kansas plates. And I happened to have a friend of mine and his wife in my car, and I told him, I said, TL, I said, those girls from Kansas just keep honking and waving at me. I said, I think they want to talk to me. I said, just look how they honk and wave every time. Well, everybody done that, so it was kind of a joke, and they caught on. Well, the traffic light, we only had one traffic light. It turned red, and I jumped out of my car and ran, got in the back seat of their car, started to introduce myself, and as I did, the girl in the passenger seat said, I know who you are. She told me my name, and I thought, God, this is not going to be good. I find two girls that I don't know and from Kansas, and they know who I am, and I've been gone a little while. So come to find out that they had a cousin who was in the town between here and their town and had a crush on me because of sports. They did pretty good in high school, wrestling and football stuff. So that's how that came about. But what happened next is I asked this driver, her name was Dot, I asked her if she would mind riding around with me and my friends, and then let the sister take the car home, and then I would take her home in a couple hours. So we did that. We cruised Maine and went out to their local drive-in and had probably some burger and fries, I can't remember, and then I took her home. We exchanged addresses. But that was December of 1967, and I met her again, wrote letters, met her again in the middle of 68, had another date. She was in college in Kansas. I went out to get her, brought her back, and I went back to overseas, and I came back in late 68 and for another visit, and got engaged at that time because of the letters. The next time I came back was June 1969. We got married, and we was married for 51 years, and she passed away in 2020, so we had a pretty good three dates in a year and a half and 51 years of marriage. So that turned out to be pretty good.
So if I'm following this correctly, if not for a real seemingly devastating and tragic situation with your father, you wouldn't have met your wife.
That's exactly right. This is a happening that neither one of us thought was going to happen. If Dad wouldn't have had a heart attack, I wouldn't have came back to Colorado and met her.
You know, and you were talking about your dad, and I was thinking as you described hitchhiking. I'm guessing your father served in World War II?
He did, yes. He was in the United States Army. He was in the Pacific. He was in the Philippines fighting the Japanese. And as I kind of mentioned a little bit earlier, I didn't get a lot of time to talk to him because we were separated. So I had to do some research on my own to find out who he was with, what he did. He was a machine gunner, and he had a twin brother that was over there at the same time. So, they never saw each other, but they both made it home.
And a lot of guys from that generation, as yours, didn't talk about it all that much. That's one of the reasons this show exists. But I've had so many World War II veterans tell me, hitchhiking in the 40s, I mean, if you were in uniform, you'd be picked up in 10 seconds. So the contrast that you gave us of 1967 and being in uniform and having someone purposely mess with you and spit gravel all over you, that says a little bit, I guess.
Well, and going back to that, you're exactly right. And I didn't realize at that time what was happening. I just thought this guy got cold feet and decided not to do it. As I got back to my ship and started talking to some other older sailors, they had said what exactly happened. They said, well, you were in uniform, and our civilian population don't like our being over here in Vietnam because we shouldn't be here. So it was probably just an attack against you rather than whatever. So I kept that in the back of my mind thinking, well, that's probably what it was. And I've heard stories from other veterans in airports. What actually happened is the commanding officers were starting to tell their soldiers and sailors, travel in civilian clothes. Mm-hmm. When you go to an airport, be in civilian clothes. Avoid the conflict. Don't go up and give anybody a chance to say something to you. So that's pretty much what I did from then on out. I flew and went on the buses on civilian clothes.
And I know a lot of your fellow Vietnam veterans are hearing this right now and nodding their heads because they had similar experiences. So you told us about some of the opportunities you had to come back, and eventually you get married. But what about that time aboard ship? You were talking about what your duties entailed with the cargo crew and unloading all those choppers. Now, I'm guessing that went according to plan every single time you guys ever did it, right?
Well, no, there were a few hitches, but let me take you right back before I got back to my ship in 68. When I left the States to come back after I met my future wife, I was in Clark Air Force Base for probably about a day, and then we caught another flight and went to Saigon, Vietnam. When we landed, when our C-130 landed, we're all in what we call Class A uniforms. No weapons, it's a dress uniform, stuff like that. So we were basically harmless. We couldn't do anything to anybody. Well, the North Vietnamese took an opportunity when our plane came in to come out and shoot the tires out from underneath the plane on the tarmac, which pretty much deadened the plane right there. And if it wouldn't have been for the Army and the perimeter guards in Jeeps with 20 calibers, I don't know what would happen. We talked about it afterwards. They think there was going to be an attack on the plane and take all of us out. There was 100 of us plus more. So it would have taken out quite a few veterans if they could have done it. But this was distorted by the perimeter Army, so they saved our butts. But from getting off the plane then, getting to Air Force, Army, Navy, Marines, we all were on that airplane, different branches. But we all had different places to go to in Saigon, and my place was called the Annapolis Hotel, and it was just kind of a cute name for an old Vietnam hotel that we now took over to billet our officers and our enlisted men. But that night when we got into our bunks, we heard what they call small arm fire, and all of us hit the deck and knew that there was some kind of a problem, but didn't know what, but we was unarmed, so stupidly we hid behind mattresses. Well, yeah, you smile, exactly. What's a mattress going to do with an AK-47, you know? It's just going to put up a bunch of feathers.
If things had gone a little differently there in Vietnam, we wouldn't have an organization called Veterans Honoring Veterans. And we'll hear more about that when we come back with more of Bart Bartholomew's story. Check out photos and a short video with Bart on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And don't forget to investigate National Vietnam War Veterans Day events in your area. That's coming up March 29th, and Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with a Navy veteran of the Vietnam War in Loveland, Colorado. Bart Bartholomew is the founder of a group called Veterans Honoring Veterans, which has carved out a unique niche in how to do just that. When we left off, the sailor from the amphibious assault ship USS Valley Forge had been sent to Saigon, experiencing a scare when the North Vietnamese shot out his C-130's wheels upon landing.
So anyway, after the shooting was all over, we all got downstairs and we found out that there was two officers, an incident, Lieutenant J.G. that got killed by the North Vietnamese, we call him Charlie, that got in there. And here again, they were intending to do harm. So the next morning, we all went to the armory that they had in that hotel. And there was a chief petty officer that was issuing all these Navy guys M16s. And I'm talking with other guys. I'm saying, what's this about? You know, I said, I hope they don't plan on me using one of them. I've never been trained on it. He was joking. He said, I haven't either. So when I got up there, I told Chief, I said, Chief, I said, I'm a fleet sailor. I went from basic training onto the ship. I said, I had no small arms fired. I didn't even say that. I said, no experience in shooting this rifle. And I said, I'm a lover, not a fighter. Well, I said it kind of as a joke, and he didn't really take his joke, so he literally shoved the M16 into my chest. There was a corporal in the Marine Corps over there, and he says, Corporal, bring this lover two bandoliers of ammunition and take him over to the embassy, show him who he's going to be while he's here. So I ended up being on the embassy roof in Saigon, and after it was all said and done, I got back to my ship, and the talk gets around that Tet Offensive was starting in Vietnam, and the North was trying to take over the South, and this was just one Tet Offensive they had. So the skirmish that I was in was just a small taste of what our guys did over there and how they had to protect themselves. I was scared to death, but I didn't feel I was really in too much danger, but I saw an awful lot of what they call parachute flares, and I saw what they call tracers that you follow the line of tracers, stuff like that. So, and I was with a Marine, and the Marine did show me exactly how to load and fire the M16. And if I'd had to use it, I was a small kid and from Eastern Colorado. I knew weapons. I there were no problem with that. But this is not a 12-gauge shotgun, and it's not a 410, and it's not a pistol. It's a machine gun, and we didn't even hear about it in basic training. So. But then I got back to my ship, and things started settling down, and we had a lot of instances. We had a helicopter that we have tie-downs on the front nose and then on the back wheels to keep the ship from the aircraft from rolling back and forth, and if any foul weather or anything, just keep them down. But when they get ready to go, they take these tie-downs off. One of them did get taken off completely off the front of the aircraft when he lifted up his rotors, leaned forward, and the what they call the LSO, leading signalman officer, got hit with one of the rotors, and he was killed. That was the first traumatic thing that we saw on our ship, and then we had another guy get blown off the ship with helicopter wash. We realized that we was in a situation where it wasn't TV, it was actually going on, and we could see shells being lobbed in from other ships. We saw the USS New Jersey shoot some 16-inch projectiles into the Vietnam, and that was something to watch. But that's about it, my Navy career. I stayed in the Navy for 4 years and went to Vietnam on one ship three times, another ship one time, so I deployed four times.
Well, and as you were telling the story about the embassy getting thrown on the roof with a gun that you've never really been trained on, I'm sure you know that very embassy was later under attack, like taken over for a while.
Well, it was, and also there's an iconic picture of a Huey helicopter that's hovering above the very, very top portion of that embassy, and all the Vietnamese were coming up ladders trying to get off of it. They was doing that. There was just one helicopter after another. But the embassy did get taken over eventually.
So that rooftop that's in that photo, that's where you were?
Yeah, that's exactly where I was. I got a picture of it downstairs on my wall just because I want to say that's where I was.
And timing is everything, as we've heard a few times in your story. And you mentioned you were on another ship, too, besides the Valley Forge?
Yeah, my two ships are pretty patriotic, USS Valley Forge, and the second one was USS Paul Revere. So they both have East Coast ties. And the Paul Revere was a troop transport ship. It carried Marines, and it also carried cargo. And those ships would meet up with a ship like my first one and exchange cargo and transport men over from one place to the other. They had a small little helipad on the back. So I was only on that for 6 months, just long enough to get deployed back to Vietnam when my wife was 9 months pregnant. So I was overseas when my first daughter was born. And got the news by, again, telegram, mm-hmm. that mother and daughter was doing fine. Woke up the ship store guy, and he told him to bust out a bunch of cigars, and I'd pay him for them. And I woke everybody up, giving them cigars, told them I was a brand-new daddy. And they said, shut up, let me go back to sleep. We don't care if you're a daddy or not. They wanted to sleep.
Well, and the enemy doesn't care, unfortunately, if you're a daddy or not either. Was that a little different for you, having to go back at that, especially after you've already been there and you know what you're up against and what you're up to over there? Did that feel a little different going back when you know she's about to give birth?
Oh, absolutely. We had to drive from San Diego to Burlington, Colorado, through the desert. It was really, really hot, and you got a 9-month pregnant lady in the back seat on vinyl seats. It was not a fun ride for her, and it scared me to death. But I got her home safely, got her to where I felt comfortable that she was being taken care of by. She was living with her mom, and my mom was only 30 miles away, so they were all there real close, so everything came out. I got pictures, but here again, now that's nothing. Mail, you didn't get mail within 2 or 3 days. You got mail within 2 or 3 months, and sometimes there's 10 or 15 letters. My fiance at the time, we decided that what we needed to do is to number the letters, because I would get a letter that told me that something happened, and I should have got a letter 3 days before saying this was going to happen. And then I already knew what happened. Then I find out later on, oh, this is what happened. That's why it happened. So, yeah, mail was interesting to get and send.
Yeah, and you gave us a story about hitchhiking that illustrated some of the public sentiment about the war. But you, I'm sure, had a different perspective being aboard ship, serving with all those other men, whether they were enlisted or officers or whatever. What would you tell us about the men you served with and how you felt about what you were doing over there?
It was pretty easy to do. We knew he was there for a reason. Every one of us on that ship were volunteers. None of us were forced to. We didn't get drafted. We might got draft notices, but we pretty much served voluntarily. And people are listening. You've heard this many times. Everybody in the military signs a blank check. Everybody in the military raises their right hand, unless they're draftees, raise their right hand, swears to uphold the Constitution, friendly or domestic or foreign, and we don't know what's going to happen when we come out of basic training. So once I got over there, I felt my job and my duty was pretty much set in concrete. I had no problem with it. The guys I worked with, this combat cargo crew, we only had at the most 12, but many times it was just about 8. Of us working together, just like anybody else. You come really, really close. Found out about their families, found out about their moms and dads, found out about their sports and all that kind of stuff. So you had downtime where you could just visit with each other. Going back to the mail system, well, the folks from home would send care packages. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't know what a care package is, but it's a wonderful cardboard box that's got candy and cookies and fudge and stuff like that from home. And when one of those comes, it's not for one person. It gets shared with everybody because everybody's wanting a piece of home. The fudge don't look like fudge. The cookies don't look like cookies. And a lot of times they're all mixed together, which is also fine. You don't know what you're getting because the mail system, it's not like UPS and FedEx. It's not square boxes that come anymore. They're kind of smushed together, but it was always fun to get them.
Well, it's probably a good reminder for some folks listening who know someone serving right now that care packages are still a thing, and groups like Operation Packing Company or the Blue Star Moms can help you send some on their way. You mentioned, you're overseas when your daughter was born. How old was she when you finally got home?
Right at 4 months. my wife saying, she says, "Yeah, you got here just in time for when she's sleeping all through the night." Because, babies have a tendency to wake you up several times when they're infants. And but yeah, she was 3 months old. I've got a what I want to call an iconic picture. On the day of my discharge, I got discharged to San Francisco, stayed in my uniform, flew all the way home because I didn't care who saw me. I was proud to show up my uniform, so I stayed in it. And I got home, and as I walk in the door, it's my mom and my wife and my newborn baby. I get the baby in my arms, and I got my wife looking over the shoulder at me, looking at the baby, and my mom captured a picture of the three of us. It's probably one of the best, nothing against my second daughter, but it's probably one of the best pictures I've ever been in, and it was just fun. But now I'm 10,000 miles away. Waiting for pictures of the new baby, and the mail doesn't come fast enough. But I was not the first, and I won't be the last, of a military man being overseas when their babies are born. Sometimes they don't see them until they're close to a year old. They just get pregnant. When they leave, they stay over there 9 months, and then the baby's walking by the time they come home.
Yeah, and I'm sure everyone can imagine what it felt like in that moment, but I think I need to ask you that. What did that feel like because you've been waiting for months, and you don't really know if you're going to get to meet her, to finally meet your own child for the first time when she's 4 months old. What did that feel like?
If I could describe it, I should have the picture. The smile on my face would tell everything. I was a proud peacock. My feathers were really showing. I was so proud. I was a proud expecting dad, too, because I would walk around with my pregnant wife and say, "Look what I did." And everybody knew exactly what I was talking about, but I was awful proud of her. She was a beautiful pregnant mother, and the second baby was just important, but it was a different thing when I was so far away and not being able to be with my wife during the birth. That's what I wanted to do, is be there to hold her hand, because I heard so much about it. We didn't have Lamaze back in those days. You just did what you had to do to be there for the delivering mother.
Was it a challenge for you to transition back to civilian life and be here with a young wife and baby after everything you'd been living over there?
Not really. I went to a small town, my hometown, and I got a job with a high school buddy. His dad owned a sugar beet company, and they made sugar beet equipment. And this buddy of mine was in the Army, and he stepped on a landmine and had got part of his face injured while he was over there. So he and I had stuff to talk about. The war was there. It was still going on. I was perfectly fine with what I was doing, and I never had a bit of problem transitioning. The biggest thing I had was when I was in Tonsonute Air Base in Saigon. Then the second thing was our ship during Tet had to become a mortuary. There were so many casualties in 1968 in May that they did not have enough to place them. They had them in the hospital ships over there, and we was the largest ship, and we had the biggest space. So we would hold two different times over 200 young Marines in body bags, and again, combat cargo. It was their job to be the perimeter guards for these body bags, making sure they was safe. Not that they wouldn't be, but it's one of those things that you protect them. Ships would come in and helicopters come in. We'd load up X number of them and take them in country, and then they would get on the plane. They'd be sent back home to their families. That bothered me. That never even came out in conversation probably for 40 years. It was something that I just, you hold something in. I could say that now. I didn't realize what I was doing to myself at the time. So as far as transitioning, I was able to do what I needed to do as a father, as a husband. We had another baby. I came out of the Navy, and I joined a law enforcement agency, and I did that for 22 years. That was harder being a police officer for me than it was in Vietnam because of the carnage I saw in car accidents. So counseling would have been really, really good in law enforcement back in the 70s, but there was no such thing as that either. But Vietnam was pretty easy for me, and I can't say that for all my brothers because of what we all know about the 22, and I understand that's a number that's going to stay, but it's not realistic. It's been more than that several times. If you don't know what 22 is, audience, look it up. It's all over the internet, and it'll explain to you just exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and there's another number, rounded to 58,000, the number of names on that wall. When the wall was built, was it something that you wanted to see, or someone was going to have to twist your arm to get you there?
They had a floating wall, a traveling wall, and it came into Colorado in the 80s, 90s maybe, and I had an opportunity to go to it. Now, I had two sailors on there. I didn't really have a problem with it, but I said to myself, if I ever see the wall, I'm going to see the real one. But that didn't happen. It came back to Colorado again, and I went and etched the names of those two sailors, and I've got them in my Navy book. But I've seen that traveling wall several times, and I've been fortunate enough to be on the honor flight from Colorado, and I got to see the wall in person, and it's unreal to see how big a wall that is and how many names there are on there. And I have a shirt that I wear once in a while that's in memory of the 58,497, whatever it is. So I make everybody know that I'm a former member of the military.
Well, and I'm glad you brought up the honor flight, because when we started our honor flight in my area over a decade ago, our mission was just to get the World War II guys there. And now that we're taking primarily Vietnam vets, when I go speak about this, I tell people I think it's more important for your generation than it was for the World War II generation, because we see how it changes guys' view of their own service. And sharing the experience with other veterans is one thing, but to see how your generation is treated now compared to then. Do you have maybe some examples from that honor flight that underscore that contrast?
Absolutely. There's nothing more vitalizing a human being that's been in the military as that honor flight. You are treated like royalty. I mean, you've got a guardian that might be older than you, but he wanted to, or she wanted to be part of the honor flight to help you go back and see this. So, boy, anything you wanted, you had, and to get the treatment. And one of the biggest things that you'll hear when they land in Baltimore and they get on the runway between the terminals, you get nothing but applause and claps and shaking of the hands and hugs from strangers. And you didn't get this when you came home. So when you said more for the Vietnam than so for the World War II, take nothing away from World War II, the greatest generation, fighting two wars at the same time in both oceans. It's just nothing, but we kept them from coming home. That we didn't fight on our land. We fought on everybody else's land, and we got to always remember that. And today, the same thing. We are fighting in other lands and not home. 9/11 was the closest thing we've ever had to a war in the States.
And, you know, the World War II guys had to wait 60 years for their memorial, and they had to pay for it to get it there. And that's why that was so important, to give them a chance before it was too late. But I think the reason I say it's more important now, because what I see is it's righting a wrong. And your generation has carried with you for decades this feeling of almost being rejected for trying to serve your country, for risking your own life. And now, all of a sudden, your service is seen in the same light as the guys who came before you. And I don't want to put words in your mouth or thoughts in your head, but have you experienced that kind of shift in how you realized you were perceived as a Vietnam veteran?
Oh, absolutely. This has come up in conversation quite a bit. And I can't prove this, but I think what helped the Vietnam veterans be recognized as a veteran, as somebody that done something good for the American people, I think somebody found a baseball cap that said U.S. Army or U.S. Navy somewhere and put it on. And somebody saw it and looked at it and said, oh, you as Navy, so was I. And then pretty soon it started spreading around. And then somebody said, we can make some money on hats. So they started making all kinds of hats. So as a veteran from Vietnam, I don't care if it's – and the Iraqi and Afghanistan guys, they very seldom wear hats. So we can't identify them. There's a few of them out there. And the Korean War vets are now wearing hats too. So we see a hat, we go out of it. We'll go across the street to talk to them sometimes. That leads up to another thing that's going on here in Northern Colorado. We have an awesome breakfast club that is just unbelievable as far as what's going on. But that's also bringing to the table veterans that can talk about what they did, because they're sitting across the table from another veteran or the veteran's family, and they're sharing these stories. What we do at our breakfast club is just unbelievable. We get return people just every Saturday and get 6 to 12 people, brand new ones every Saturday, so it's blown out of proportion, but it's awful fun.
And not only has that breakfast club grown exponentially, so has the impact of Bart Bartholomew's nonprofit, Veterans Helping Veterans. The rest of that story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Ever feel like that dollar just doesn't go as far anymore? Well, join the club. Actually, you really should join the club. I mean, join the more than 350,000 members of EECU, the not-for-profit credit union now in 12 California counties. Free online and mobile banking, more than 30,000 co-op ATMs, and not just fair, but fantastic rates on auto loans, mortgages, and home equity lines of credit. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today, or just call this number, 1-800-538-3328. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with Vietnam veteran Bart Bartholomew of Loveland, Colorado. Check out the photos and a short video online for a better feel of his organization, Veterans Honoring Veterans, and the impact it has. And the next time you venture through Northern Colorado on a weekend, maybe you want to stop by what they call the PAM Vets Breakfast.
It started in 2008 with two World War II veterans. Let's go back to the Greatest Generation, how they do stuff and how they get stuff done. Two World War II veterans sitting having coffee at a McDonald's on West Eisenhower here in Loveland. Word got out that there was a couple guys there, and pretty soon two or three more. Management said, you know, there's so many of you here that our patrons can't come in and sit down and have a pancake because there's so many veterans. So we found a restaurant, and the restaurant turned his bar into a buffet, and we stayed there for several years. But now we're in the Golden Corral here in Loveland, and from two veterans sitting at a table, we have now between 150 and 170 come to our breakfast. Now that 150 or 170, probably 90% of them are veterans, but they also bring their families, their wives and their girlfriends, not at the same time. I want to make sure that they, I always tell them, you can bring your wife or your girlfriend, but not funny, yeah. But like I said, we get 6 to 12 brand new ones every Saturday. We've probably got over 4,000 veterans that walk through our doors from probably just about 30% of the states in the United States. So we've got something that nobody else has, and we're awful proud of it. We've had over 200. It's just awesome.
Well, there might be some veterans listening that are going to come through this part of the country. So if they want to join you, what do they do?
Just get up in the morning and be at the Golden Corral at 1360 Sculpture Drive in Loveland at 8 o'clock. Get in the long waiting line that you're going to see out there, and we don't care what the weather is. We'll freeze our butts off to get in there and have breakfast. But all you got to do is show up, and there is a membership dues, and that's you have to buy your own breakfast. But then that's a lifetime membership, because once you're a member, you're a member, but you can come back anytime.
And that's every single Saturday?
Every Saturday. And every Saturday, I'll say this again, between 150 and 170. We fill half of it up every Saturday.
Well, I hope some people listening will come by and check it out. And I hope they'll also take a look at veteranshonoringveterans.org. And let's talk about that. You've made a couple references to the year 2020 and a few ways that your life changed that year. But what's the origin of Veterans Honoring Veterans?
Most military organizations usually have a reunion. My reunion started in 1970, the year they decommissioned the ship. And it's been going on ever since. There have been 54 reunions. And at one reunion, a sailor got up at the banquet. He was in full uniform. He was a Navy officer. And he got a microphone. He said, "Would John Q. Sailor please come up?" And John Q. Sailor came up, and he introduced him and said, "John Q. Sailor did this on the Valley Forge, and I'd like to present him with a statue with his name on it, and thank you for your service," and that was it. So after the banquet, my wife and I went and found him and his wife, and I said, "This is pretty cool what you're doing." I said, "Is this a franchise? Do you have to buy into it?" Or I said, "Is it something that anybody can do?" He says, "You want to do it, do it. Get a bunch of people together and see if they want to do it." So I came back, and I contacted five veterans and one civilian, and I told them what I saw and gave them a look at what the statue looked like, and actually started in 2018. 2020 was the time when COVID came, where we couldn't go to breakfast. But what we do with this Veterans Honor Veterans is the first and third Saturdays, from the people that come to breakfast, we get a list, and we pull names out of that list, and we call them and get all the information that we can to put on a nameplate to make this statue personalized. And then on the first and third Saturdays, we award them the statue in front of their peers. It's kind of like a bunch of paparazzis. Everybody got to get up there and take pictures. We have it videoed. If you go on to veteransveterans.org, you'll be able to see videos on there. If you go to NOCO Veterans Honor Veterans Facebook, you'll find a bunch of stuff on there. But the first and third Saturdays, come to breakfast, get your name on the list. If you're local and can come back, We'll get your statue and present it to you.
So I'm sure some people are wondering this, so I've got to ask it. How many of these statues have you handed out now?
Proud to say over 900. Starting from scratch and getting a nonprofit put together and getting your 501c3 all set up. To be able to say 900 is pretty cool. I'm just looking for that 1,000. We're going to make a big splash on Broadway when that 1,000 do something for that veteran. But it's so rewarding. Paul, we literally see tears coming from 70 and 80 year old people's eyes because somebody's saying thank you to them that never said thank you before. They might have got medals, but everybody got medals. It was just salad on your plate, you know, just something to wear. But these statues, I have guys coming up to me all the time. He says, "Bart, it's right next to my TV. When I'm not watching TV, I can look over and see my statue, or it's on my mantle, or it's here, or it's there, but it's where everybody can see when they come in." So that makes me feel pretty good that it doesn't go home in a box and get put in the closet.
Yeah, in fact, I'm just going to go out on a limb and guess that you've probably been to some memorial services where those statues were part of the display of that veteran's memorabilia.
Several times. The family members will take their statue to the memorial and put it on the table with the urn or the flag. As a matter of fact, my youngest daughter is a member of the VFW Auxiliary out in Oklahoma, and she read a story in the paper about a Korean War veteran who had become a POW and an MIA, and also he died while he was in captivity and buried somewhere over there, and his remains were just found middle of last year, and by DNA they found out who he was, and he only had nieces and nephews still alive. But my daughter asked if we could possibly send a statue out for him, so she got me the information, and when she sent me pictures of the memorial, there on the table was the United States flag in its folded case, the urn of the veteran, and the statue that she had presented them in honor of his service. So they've been all over the United States. It's usually Northern Colorado, but it's getting popular enough that people saying, "Can I buy one and send one to my cousin or my uncle or I've got a brother out in North Carolina. We saw on YouTube one time a 97-year-old World War II sergeant, female sergeant in the Marine Corps, out in North Carolina, and we got information on where she was. We sent her one and her pictures in our veterans on veterans.org. So we give them to the people here, but if you want one for somebody else out of town, we ask that you donate the amount of cost that it cost us. And if we ship it, we ask you to pay for the shipping and handling. And they're never batting an eye. They'll do that. That's not very much.
Well, and that was another question, obviously, because 900 trophies, they're not free. You know, people that have bought a plaque or a trophy know it's not exactly inexpensive. So where does the money come from to provide these statues for veterans?
Well, we started out knocking on doors. We got a postcard, and we take this postcard around and stop at businesses and tell them what we was doing and tell them it was a 501c3, that we was tax deductible. We could give them a letter saying that they donated to us. That's the way it started. Now we still do fundraisers every once in a while. We'll go to a restaurant. They'll give us a percentage of the meals that are bought per day. But a lot of the money just comes from good-natured people. We have a website. We got a donation button on there, and we'll find every once in a while two or three PayPals that come in there. We don't even know these people, and there's a place to write notes, and they'll just thank you for what you're doing. So it's well known we're doing good. Another dollar would never hurt. If you're inclined to do that, go on a website and find it and feel free to donate, and we'll get you a letter if you do taxes and write it off.
Again, that's veteranshonoringveterans.org. We'll link it as well at hometownheroesradio.com. And there's another question that comes to mind. I mean, you've got 900 of them that have gone out. You're looking forward to celebrating that 1,000th veteran who receives his. But there's probably a long, long, long list of people who could receive these statues. So how long do you plan to keep doing this, Bart?
As long as I'm upright. I got a wonderful board of directors and a bunch of volunteers. So should that day come that I can't do some of this stuff, I'm sure someone will be more than glad to take it over. But as I said, we get a dozen new ones every Saturday. And then also, as I said, we only give 6 or 7 away on 2 Saturdays. So we're getting twice as many veterans coming in every month than we're giving out. So this list does not get smaller. It continues to get bigger, and it's kind of a lottery type thing when we pick names. We try to look for the repeat people, the ones that come back to breakfast more than once. If you're one and done, we never see you again. It's probably not one of those things I'm even going to look at your name because I don't know who you are. But if you come back and you keep talking to me, I'm going to recognize you. I'm going to see your name, and then I'm going to get your telephone number, and I'm going to give you a call, and you're going to get a statue. But I probably got 1,000 veterans in the waiting list.
You probably have 1,000 stories, too, of how you've seen this make a difference for the veterans who receive them. But I'm wondering if maybe there's a favorite story. Maybe it was something unexpected that kind of reminded you of why you do this.
Yeah, I think in the first part of this interview, I mentioned the fact that we all signed a blank check. And when I pick up the telephone and dial a telephone number of a veteran, there's been a number of times that I'll get, I didn't really do anything, Bart. Thank you. I appreciate it. It's an honor to have you thank me, but go find someone else because they're more deserving. And I go deeper into that conversation with that veteran, and I say what I said. We all signed this blank check. We all raised our right hand. So whether we was a clerk typist that was writing orders, or if we was the mess cook that was serving, or if we was the instructor of the pilot somewhere in the States, we all did something in the cause of protecting the United States and the people who live here. So I try to convince those people that they are just as important, no matter if they didn't get the Purple Heart, they didn't get the Bronze Star, they didn't get all the awards. I didn't get those awards, and I just about turned down this interview because I didn't think I was special enough. I'm not special. I'm just another veteran who raised their right hand, and I'm honored to be able to do this. But a story you mentioned, I wasn't doing the phone calling at the time. One of my directors were, and she got a veteran who was an Air Force veteran, and Air Force and Coast Guard do not get enough pats on the backs to what they did to help the cause. So anyway, she interviewed the guy, and he said exactly that. He said, find somebody that did a little bit more to serve the country. So 2 weeks went by, and he had her number, and he called her back, and he said, I got to talk to a couple other guys who's received these statues. I'd like to see if I could get one. Well, this particular individual, when she got his story, being an Air Force guy, he was deep in the jungles of Air Force in Vietnam, just like other people were. He got wounded three times, got three Purple Heart, got the Bronze Star. So he was highly, highly decorated. He is the only one in our statues that we put nameplates on the side of his base of his statue as well in the front, because if you ever see one of our statues, it's got the logo, it's got the name of the veteran, the rank of the veteran, when they was in, if they was in a conflict, and then maybe a ship's patch or a unit patch or a medal or something like that. Well, this guy had so many that we decided to put him on the side because of his distinguished record. And when it was presented to him, he looked at the front of it. That's all he saw. And he was just elated about it and knew he did the right thing by getting it. And after the ceremony was over, I thank everybody. I go out there and shake their hands. And I said, what did you think of the nameplate? Did I get it correct? He says, yeah. And I said, I don't know if I got the medals correct. He said, you got those two just right? No, I said, I'm talking about the other ones. He looked on the side, and that's where the tears came, because we had at least two of medals on each side or more. And like I said, we can't do that for everybody, and we quit doing it. But that was a story where a guy said, I didn't do anything, and he was wounded three times.
Yeah, the guys who do the most act like they did the least. And I'm back to that with you saying you almost turned down this interview. I'm glad you didn't, and I want to say thank you for serving our country, and thank you for serving your fellow veterans. Is there anything else that you think people ought to understand about veterans, honoring veterans, or the causes you're involved in here in Northern Colorado?
Just it's fun. It's honoring and rewarding for me to be able to not only talk to these veterans, but I'm going to bring one thing up here. The ones that don't get enough attention is the nurses from all wars, World War II and Korea and Vietnam. You've got to stop and think on how long they were on their feet and what they kept seeing. Young boy after young boy after young boy. Now, these are not 40 and 50 year old guys. These are teenagers that are coming into their MASH units and they're taken care of. Nobody talks about those nurses, and I've been punching it. And matter of fact, we just put a new statue in our fleet of a female veteran in her what we call a work uniform saluting. So now we have a statue where the girl can have one in uniform. If they don't, we give them that eagle that you see on that right side, and you can see it on the website also. One other thing before, a little bit about veteran on veteran. We have no rank. There's no rank in PAMVETS or with us. We've got E1s and we've got generals. We got a general and his wife that come just about every Saturday. He's getting some health challenges, but he's there as often as he can. He's a Brigadier General, U.S. Army, started out as enlisted, turned over and became an officer. He's got a daughter that's also in the Army. She's a full colonel, and she's a former helicopter pilot. So we've got everything out there. We got the mess cook, and we got the Silver Stars. We even had a Congressional Medal of Honor come through. I didn't give him a statue, but the Congressional Medal of Honor came through our Golden Corral a few months ago. And he was here long enough to do a presentation for a fundraiser for a memorial we got going in here. But Northern Colorado is a place on the map that if you haven't been here, come here. If you're a veteran, please stop in and see us. We want every veteran that's got an opportunity. There's always a chair in our... The PAMVET motto is, no veteran sets alone. So if you come in and you are by yourself and you get a table and there's nobody with you, one of us is going to come over and sit down with you and visit with you. So PAMVET stands for PAMVET, Proud American Veteran. On the back of my card, Paul, you'll see an invitation to that breakfast club. So what I do is I got a twofer card, two for one. I give them one card that has information about veterans, honor veterans, and on the back it's got the time and date for PAMVETS, making sure PAMVETS gets a lot of the credit, because that's where this all started.
And you never know where it's going to go, but I can hear, and I think everyone can, the heart behind it. And you know that new female veteran statue you have? I might have to order one of those for my mother, who was an Army nurse in the Vietnam era. And I want to ask you about another woman, because I just have a feeling that as you talk about all this and the story of where the statue phenomenon started, that you and your wife were together at a USS Valley Forge reunion. Do you ever have days where you feel like she's up there cheering you on?
Every day. Every day I got a little tiny memorial of her over there on the below the TV, and I got some of her ashes in a tea light that I light up. So yeah, she's my cheerleader. She was part of it. She knew what was going on. She would help me. But actually, my house is my office, because this is where I don't make the statues. Oh, by the way, the statues are made by an American soldier, Vietnam veteran, here in Loveland, Colorado. We're proud to say that this is an American-based story, and everything around it is American-based. But yeah, my wife's my cheerleader. Everybody that listened, thanks for listening. And every veteran, thanks for your service. And for those who were in conflict, welcome home.
Welcome home. Two words any Vietnam veteran in your life will definitely appreciate hearing March 29th on National Vietnam War Veterans Day. Or really, any day. You never know how big a difference you might make. VeteransHonoringVeterans.org is the website if you want to honor a veteran in your life or support Bart Bartholomew's work. That's all the time we have on the radio today, but thank you so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.